Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, I have here a book in my hand. It's called Black and White Thinking, The Burden of a Binary Brain in a Complex World. Basically, it argues that our brain thinks in black and white. That's really kind of it. It likes to sort and categorise along simple lines. The danger with that is that when it comes to categorising people, this can lead us to stereotype and pigeonhole. The book argues that we need to understand how our brain works in order to overcome it. By doing that, we can make more subtle and better decisions necessary for the modern and complex world in which we live. The book is written by Dr. Kevin Dutton, a research psychologist at Oxford and Cambridge, and he joins me now. Kevin, you're very welcome to the programme. Kevin, am I letting us all off a bit lightly by putting it bluntly like this? Are we all more or less hardwired to discriminate and frame everything in black and white, and hey, that's just the way it is?
I think we're certainly hardwired to frame everything in black and white, Dave. Discrimination is something which is built onto that. I'll give you a great example. I mean, the story which first inspired me to write the book happened 100 or so years ago. Russia and Finland were renegotiating the border between the two countries, and it happened to go right through the middle of a Finnish farmer's farm. So literally one half was in his barn was on one half of the border, and his cowshed was on the other half of the border. And one day the Russian and Finnish authorities turned up on his doorstep, and they said, you know what, you're going to have to decide which side of the border you're going to live on. Do you want to live in Russia or do you want to live in Finland? Because we've got a census coming up and we need to figure out who's eligible. Well, the Finnish farmer was getting on in years, and this put him in a bit of a tricky position, because Russia had been very good to him over the years. They'd given him subsidies for the farm. They'd given him help on the land. So he didn't want to upset the Russian authorities. But at the same time, as you can imagine, he was Finnish and he wanted to see out his days in Finland. So he thought very hard about it. And he said to the delegation that had turned up, look, I'm very grateful to Russia over the years for all the help that they've given me. But I'm getting on a bit in years now, and I'd like to see out my days in Finland. The truth is, I don't think I could survive another Russian winter.
Very good,
yeah,
yes.
I know, it's a funny story. Obviously, the border going right through his farm. We're only talking a matter of millimetres, Dave. But yeah, of course, there's a profound wisdom in this story that we think our brains have been programmed by evolution to think very much in the way that light travels. We think in fast, straight lines, just like light travels. And we have to think like that, Dave, because that's the way we make sense of our environment. There was a wonderful episode, I don't know if you ever watched The Simpsons, a few years ago, and they featured a supermarket in there called Monstro Mart. And the mantra of Monstro Mart, the motto was, where shopping is a baffling ordeal. And, you know, the product choice was unlimited. Shelves went right up to the ceiling. I think it was nutmeg came in 12-pound boxes. And there was a sign on the express checkout which read 1,000 items or less. And that's very much what our environments are like to us when we perceive them raw, as it were. Everything is much of a muchness. So we need to have a categorization instinct in order to make sense of our environment and to divide it up into manageable forms, a little bit like cutting up food for a child on a plate. It's too much for us to take in all at once.
Okay, well, like, if the other side of all this, by the way, like, if the brain isn't digital, but you know, we usually are kind of an either-or situation. Is the opposite to binary, is this kind of a spectrum thinking? In other words, we should be considering multiple options, alternatives and possibilities that kind of sit in this grey zone. It's the grey bit I want to mention here, that's really what we should realise is there and should be explored.
That's exactly right. I mean, actually, Dave, in everyday life, in the world in general, everything is on a spectrum. Very, very few things are truly binary. And we need, you know, we need to bear that in mind, that everything is on a spectrum. But we can't live without our ability to truncate, to categorize. I mean, I'll give you a great example. I mean, you know, just think if you went into a library and there was no library classification system and you wanted to order a book. You know, the librarian goes off and tries to find the book, but actually there's no classification system. You'd never find the damn thing. You're looking forever. whatever. Imagine if you went to a zoo and there was no classification between the animals. Again, it wouldn't work, would it? Or, you know, I mean, you were in the music business for years. You know, imagine on Spotify, there are, I think, something like 4,000 different genres of music. You know, we have to be able to divide the world up into little black and white pieces in order to make sense of it and the relationships between the various components. But actually, yes, you're right. In reality, everything is on a spectrum, really.
Well, then, if we like to do what you just mentioned there, which is to simplify things in some ways, it doesn't mean we're lazy. It doesn't mean, you know, it's not efficient or not focused on that. But we do like to split things into two categories, you know, kind of either or kind of thing, right and wrong, etc. And, you know, there are people who split things into two groups and people who don't and all the rest. So binary thinking, it's supposed to simplify things, but it doesn't. And binary thinking is a form of generalization, right?
That's right. Well, it's exactly right. I mean, we have a categorization instinct, Dave, which evolution hardwired our brains to have in order, as you say, to simplify the world, in order to save time, and in order to make it easier for us to do stuff. The problems start arising when we start categorizing, as we do, and we're all guilty of it, when we start categorizing the social world into different boxes. And we have to do that as well, just as much as we have to categorize the physical world. But it's when we start categorizing people into different boxes, that's where the problems start.
Is your book an alarm call, do you think, Kevin?
I think it is. In many ways, it is, Dave. I mean, there's a very famous study which hasn't been mentioned in any of the popular media in recent times, which I'll tell you about very briefly. And this is why it's an alarm call. Back in 1970, there was a very famous social psychology experiment conducted. And what these scientists did was they got a bunch of students in a university and they sat them down in front of a computer screen and they presented an array of dots. There were a lot of dots, and they presented to them very quickly on the computer screen. And the students' task was they had to estimate very quickly, very impulsively, how many dots they saw on the computer screen in front of them. Now, because there were a hell of a lot of dots, Dave, and because they didn't have very much time to make their estimates, they had no real idea how accurate they were. And that wasn't the point of the experiment. The point of the experiment was that this little ruse enabled the experimenter, enabled the scientist who was running the experiment, to divide them up, to divide the students up into two completely random and arbitrary groups, overestimators and underestimators.
Yeah.
That was the only way in which he divided them up. It mattered not what that device was. He just divided them up randomly like that. And what he discovered, what he went on to discover, was really interesting, because after he divided those students up into those two random groups, he then let them kind of talk to each other in their own in-groups and get to know each other in their own in-groups. And then later in the experiment, he then said to each of the students in all of the groups, I want you to rate the other students, and you've got to award a certain number of points to the other participants in the experiment. And these points will then translate into monetary rewards later on. And he wanted to look at the students and how they allocated the points and the rewards. And what he found was that just by dividing them up into those two random groups, the students would give way more points, way more money to members of their in-group, as opposed to members of the out-group. And actually, they would even try to minimize the amount that the out-group members were given at the expense of their own, in the interest of their own group. So that experiment has gone down in psychological history as being a very, very famous demonstration of the fact that we are hardwired to favor our in-groups over our out-groups at the drop of a hat.
But also in chapter 8, I mean, you've got like hyperbole, like, you know, when people say, like, how are you? And you're pretty wrecked somewhere. You say, oh, I'm dying, or I'm starving. No, you're not. I mean, like, you studied 40 undergraduates in a 60-minute slot for a few weeks. And, like, you know, the words like awesome and gross and terrified and delirious, like these labels. I mean, like, can certain words alert you that your thoughts are becoming extreme? And I'm thinking of always, never, impossible, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, Dave. And, you know, we all engage more and more and more these days in hyperbole. You know, here's a startling fact for you. Our brains take in as much information in a 24-hour period as the brains of those who lived in rural, well, I'm talking about Britain, in rural medieval Britain, would have taken in during the course of an entire life.
Yeah.
And that's a really scary thought. And this has repercussions. What you're saying there has real repercussions for social media, because this is what's driving the dichotomy at the moment. This is what's driving the hyperbole. This is what's driving what I call these identity wars. There's so much information competition out there at the moment, and so little time to take it all in, that we have what I call an informational law of the jungle. And in order for a message to get across, Dave, we've got to make it stand out as much as possible. And it's got to be black and white. We've got to use extreme words in order to make our messages ourselves heard above the clamor. And, you know, you see it here on the media here, in, you know, with the COVID situation, obviously, which is all around the world. If you look at the examples of the kinds of arguments that are used, they are always framed in binary terms. So, for instance, yeah, over here, you've got people who are saying, well, COVID, you know, is no worse than the flu. On the other side, you've got, you know, schools shouldn't reopen, universities shouldn't reopen. These are binary polar opposite arguments, but they're the arguments that rise above the clamour and get themselves heard.
Well, what about religious intolerance and political extremism? And is it a question of understanding the way our binary brains work? And that's the start to overcoming the problems of it.
Absolutely right. So you've nailed it. You've got religious extremism, political intolerance. And this isn't, you know, this isn't a modern phenomenon, Dave. This has actually been going back for centuries, indeed, you know, millennia. I mean, Aristotle, you know, was pretty much the first to write about this when he was writing, you know, that Greeks are free by nature, but barbarians are slaves by nature. You know, so this isn't a new thing. This has been going on for millennia. And I think what's exacerbated it again these days is again, you know, we come back to social media. At no time in our history, I think, has our sense of identity ever been so dependent on what we say or believe or are seen to say or believe. So I think this is the key point when we come to political and religious intolerance and bigotry. When we argue, and we're all guilty of this, Dave, even in everyday life with our friends and our families and our colleagues, when we argue or make a point, we tend to think like lawyers rather than scientists. So in other words, rather than trying to get to the truth, we try to win the argument.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm guilty of it. We're all guilty of it. And this idea, you know, of compromise or backing down is being seen ever more now as a retreat from this highly prized, high premium certainty of black and white thinking. And it's seen as a retreat into like weak and indecisive grey. And that's why we've got so much of this cancel culture. We've got othering, we've got trolling, we've got fake news. We have to win because our identities are seen to depend on.
Do you know, I'm thinking of political journalists on television asking a politician with a couple of seconds left in a program to say, blah, 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 blah. And the minister goes, well, but look, minister, it's a yes or no answer. No, it isn't. I mean, it might be a yes or no answer to you. But if the minister feels that, like, well, it's yes if this and this and this are happening, but, you know, I can't stand when people have to, like, it doesn't have to come down to that, is what I mean. So, you know, the lessons in how we can escape the pitfalls, is understanding evolutionary biology a good start?
It is, Dave, absolutely. And I would of course be cheeky and say a great way of starting this, folks, is to pick up a copy of Black and White Thinking. But I won't say that, Dave. I won't say that. But I mean, you know, talking about politics, it's exactly the same. You know, perhaps even more seriously, if I can say that, in a court of law. I mean, if you stand up in a court of law and you are asked by a defence or a prosecuting attorney or barrister, you know, is it yes or no? A clear yes or no will do. You have to answer in yes or no terms, which can give a really, really, you know, a slant on the truth, which is inappropriate to context. At
yeah,
time.
I mean,
you know, that.
Yeah, like one of the, like, we do stereotype, as you say, we pigeonhole, we draw lines. It's subliminal. We don't even know we're doing it a lot of the time. And you know, do you think that you're offering a new way of thinking, or a new way of thinking that we should be doing? And if so, what is it? What is the new way of thinking?
Well, what I'm saying, Dave, is I think what we really need to do, we need to be aware that we think in dichotomous black and white terms. And I think what you said it earlier on, I couldn't have put it better myself. The book is an alarm call. It's an alarm call to say, look, our brains are hardwired to think in this way. But there are problems with this, especially when we start, you know, putting it into the social environment. So the first thing I'm trying to do, I think, is to raise awareness of this. And I think, you know, there are a number of, you know, practical ways in which we can deal with this. I think in employment, for instance, when you look at the job market, discriminatory employment practices are endemic in society. And I think it's very simple to circumvent some of those by having things like blind auditions for various posts, removing names from application forms. There was a great study done a few months ago which looked at orchestras, which introduced the idea of blind auditions. And after blind auditions were introduced, it turned out that the orchestras were 46% more likely to hire female musicians, for example. So that's a very, very simple way in the employment environment that you can reduce this kind of thing. Also, I think it's important that we tackle the generalized assumptions that we make about people by being clear that a particular characteristic or attribute is associated with an individual and not with their group. You know, we're more likely, science shows that we're way more likely to see members of our out-group as all the same and members of our in-group as being very heterogeneous and all very different. Give me a great example of that. If you look at, you know, the number of times you see people who are obese or might be alcoholics or addicts of another kind, and it's very easy to point the finger and say, well, these people just lack willpower. So that's one argument. Well, perhaps some of them do, but actually quite a few of them might not. They might have an underlying condition. It might be a medical matter or things like that. But as soon as we start pointing the finger and saying, you know, grouping these people as one, and it's not just people who are obese or alcoholic, but any kind of people, black people, white people, immigrants, migrants, anybody, that's when we've got trouble. So we need to start thinking, yeah, okay, there's a lot of natural variation between people. And I think we need to educate ourselves. We need to raise our levels of awareness.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of a slap on the wrist situation, because you mentioned that, like, you know, that we might look upon somebody who looks foreign. You have this thing of the categorization errors. Surely we should be given out to a bit more, because we are surely predisposed, both culturally and neurologically, towards more complex thought than we usually give something.
Absolutely. And it's just the fact, I mean, we have the same brains now, Dave, pretty much as we had 3 to 5 million years ago when we were evolving, when you know, our primitive ancestors were roaming the savannas and living in caves. We have pretty much the same brain now as we did back then. What has changed is the complexity of the environment that we live in. So we evolved the brain that we have now because our ancestors lived in an environment where they had to make pretty quick decisions, which were life and death. You know, they had to pretty much make up their minds whether a rustle in the bushes was something that they could eat or was something that was going to eat them. So we had to make these either or life or death, black or white decisions very, very quickly. And we have the same brain now as we did back then. So we have this kind of impulse, this propensity to make very, very quick decisions. You know, nowadays our brain, nowadays the environment is way, way more complex. And I think that, you know, that's why we still have this kind of black and white binary propensity. I think it's been driven, what's been driving it really, really much more over recent times, certainly in the last 5 years, I dare say maybe a decade, is the exponential expansion of social media. As I was saying, I think when you look on social media, what social media does, especially over recent years, it's exposed us to the fact that there are millions of people out there that are like us, but there are millions of people out there that are not like us. And I think what this has given us is a real need to define ourselves, a new awareness that we need to define ourselves optimally. We have this desire to be individuals and unique, but we also have this desire, as I was saying a few moments ago, to be part of a collective, to be part of a group. And we're competing for very scarce, ever scarcer social resources. And as I say, everyone is clamoring for attention, and we get this kind of identity war that's going on. And I think that is increasing, and this has increased a great deal, I think, since, say, 2010, Dave. I think things have become much more polarized, much more complex on social media now. And I think that's a result of this, as I say, our growing awareness that there are millions of people like us, millions of people not like us. And we're now dependent on our views or how our views are seen to create an identity for ourselves. And that identity space is getting ever more squeezed.
Well, then finally, Kevin, I mean, obviously pushing yourself out of binary thinking, especially regarding social and political concepts, it gives you a better understanding, better expression, if you like, of your own values, your own beliefs and your own perspectives, not least somebody else's as well. And critical thinking being so important right now, Muslim, Christian there, is that a migrant or a refugee, them or us and all of that kind of thing. Could I be glib and put it this way then, that is it about training our grey matter to see that grey really does matter?
Well, I wish I'd have said that, Dave. I really do. I think you're right. I think if I can... I can't rival that, but I will give you a great quote. Probably my favourite quote in the entire book is a quote by Noel Gallagher.
Which one was Noel's one again? Oh, wait a minute! Don't tell me. Was it the one talking about his brother about the fork and the
Yeah, that was it. So yeah. Noel Gallagher said about his brother Liam. He said he's a man with a fork in a world of soup.
Yeah.
And you know what, though, Dave? I think that, Noel, I think the message of the book, if I was going to put it in a nutshell, is that Noel might have been talking about Liam being a man with a fork in a world of soup, but I think he's pretty much talking about all of us.
Yeah.
The soup is the grayness of reality, but our brains are the forks, and we're trying to fork this grayness up out of the bowl, and it's just slipping through the prongs of the fork. And that's really what the book's about. It's about awareness of that fact.
Black and White Thinking is what it's called, or the full title is Black and White Thinking, The Burden of a Binary Brain in a Complex World. And it's from Dr. Kevin Dutton, and it's fascinating, and there's loads and loads and loads of examples in it as well, as I just mentioned. Kevin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us on the programme today. And say hello to your wife for us, who's from Hoth in Dublin.
I will do. Thanks for having me on, Dave. It's been a real pleasure.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.